Hello again to all our fat cutters out there. Thanks for joining us today. I am Blythe Alberg, and joining me in the virtual studio today is Dr. Raymond Heinisch. Hi, Ray.
Hey, guys. How are you guys doing? We miss you.
Yeah, we do. Believe it or not, we think about you guys often.
We definitely do.
We want to keep our crowd pleased. We have another great podcast for y'all today. We're going to be talking about why we crave certain foods and how to fix it. I think this is something that everybody out there can relate to any degree.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's got cravings, right?
Right. Everybody experiences cravings. Even people you see walking around. You know, I might even step out on a limb to say that bodybuilders more so than, I'll say, normal people, even though bodybuilders are really normal people, but I'll say the general population, regular society, bodybuilders probably crave more because they deprive themselves. They don't make lateral shifts. So what I'm trying to say is it's not like a lasting change that they're making. They're not doing lateral shifts like we always tell people to do. They're depriving themselves of the foods they crave.
Right. So oftentimes people think that if somebody looks fit, it means that they don't have these cravings. And we're going to get into all that. You know, this is a topic that's going to require many podcasts to at least many episodes to really get through to any good extent. But I think today's podcast is going to be a lot of fun for people. I think we're going to learn a lot. Okay.
I think so, too. There's some really cool stuff in here, guys. I'm excited.
Before we get started, again, if you haven't checked us out on Facebook, do so. And if you haven't listened to some of the earlier podcasts, if you're just now getting started with us, try to go back to the beginning and download the first podcast. You know, it's a little bit on the rough side, if you will.
And I was going to say, Ray,
as we go along.
I was going to say, Ray, when's the last time? I need to go back and listen to like number one, two, and three. We had great information. I mean, it's still great information. It's just we were a little rusty at the whole like conversation thing.
Yeah, you know, but just give us a pass on that one. But listen to the information. I think it's good.
And cheer us on as we get better as we continue our podcasting journey.
Exactly. Okay, so like I said, this topic is a big topic. So we're not going to get through it all today, but I think you're going to get a lot of good golden nuggets that you guys can use right away. Okay, so we'll start with the topic of success. When we're dealing with weight loss, much of success really depends on our ability to break self-limiting beliefs and self-limiting patterns, right?
Okay, that's one way to put it. But I would say, can I make a definition myself, what I think that would be? I would say, in short, how badly do you want it? So do you want the result of what's to come more than you want that food or whatever it is at that moment, you know, then maybe you're going to go out to dinner and have dessert. Would you rather splurge on dessert at the moment, or would you want the outcome of what you're going to look like and feel like 2 weeks from now because you haven't been doing that?
Right. And it's funny you say that because I just, I just recently started re-coaching my niece. And one thing she texted me today was, she's like, I'm craving, I really want Starbucks, she exclaimed in her text. And then her very next text was, never mind, I really want to be smaller and healthier. And that's definitely part of the picture. But what we're going to talk about here is really about the self-limiting patterns that go, you know, let's say you want, I mean, everybody wants to lose weight. Everybody wants to lose fat. But sometimes something else within us takes over and overwhelms that one. It's like a biochemical thing. It's something that drives us, right?
Yes.
And that's what we're going to talk about today in today's topic on calorie density, cravings, and how to end them.
And, you know, I always hear people say, oh, I just don't have the willpower I don't have as much willpower as you. People say that all the time. And really, guys, it's not about willpower. We all have willpower. You have to give yourself credit for that. It really is not. It's like hardwired in, which we're going to get into.
Mm-hmm. Oh, don't get me started on on that topic quite yet. We'll do that on a whole nother podcast.
Okay.
Okay. So most of our patterns are really, you know, if we're looking at patterns, most patterns are like software, okay, that we have installed into our brain. And for example, you know, I have family and friends who have kids that will not eat anything but pizza, chips, bread, and French fries. I think many kids today kind of go through that phase, right? You have friends like that?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Do you have kids like that, Blythe?
I do. Both my young boys. The 4-year-old is still more experimental with food. I think kids around the age of 5, 6, 7. And it falls right in the timing when parents get real busy and it's easier to, you know, make something quick. And, you know, I think we all fall a little into that.
Even still, you know, even if you raise your kids on good food and then they start to, you know, develop social circles and they start to hang out with their friends, go to their friends' houses, and then they get exposed to what these other kids are eating.
Yeah.
They fall in love with it.
Yes. You know? That's where it all began.
You know, but here's my point. You know, kids are not born with a desire for pizza, chips, bread, and French fries, right? But they are born with a desire and a drive to eat. In fact, when we look at a child inside the womb using, you know, like ultrasound, we can see the child sucking their thumb. In essence, what they're doing is they are practicing eating even before they're born. So there's like this natural tendency for us to want to seek out food. Accurate?
Yes.
Okay, so I know that's common sense. I know that makes sense. But the reason I bring it up is because what do most people do when they try to lose weight? What is the number one tactic?
Don't get me started on this topic. This will take its own podcast. But they stop eating. They eat less calories. They stop eating.
Right. They try to cut fat by basically cutting down on all of the food that they're eating. Okay, and that's a huge mistake, isn't it?
I'm biting my tongue. Yes, it's the biggest, I think it's probably the most common mistake in the weight loss world.
Oh, it totally is. And the reason it's a mistake is because the desire or the drive to eat is hardwired. Mm-hmm. Eating, the need to eat, is not software, okay? You know, with software, we can, if we have a computer program and we have a certain software, we can remove that software from the computer or we can add a new software program in. But with hardware, your computer, that's what you've got to work with. You can't, you know, you can upgrade a computer, so it's probably not the perfect example, but it gets the point across. You have a motherboard, you've got a hard drive, you've got a DVD, a CD, ROM, on that computer. You've got the hardware to work with. Eating is built into our hardware. So if you try to not eat or you try to cut back on your food, eventually that hardware wins over the software, right?
I think you just stripped that one down to the bare bone. I love the way you said that because I think that will hit home with some people.
Okay, good. Good. So we know that eating is hardwired, but there's also this thing I call food tendency. Most people don't realize that food tendency is also hardwired, you know? So, you know, and we'll get into food tendency in a second. But basically the point is what we eat exactly, meaning what specific foods we eat is programmed into our brain, okay? But our tendency, what we are drawn to is not. What we're drawn to is hardwired. The food tendency is hardwired into our brain. So again, we can't go into a program expecting to be able to not crave specific foods, right?
Mm. So
we can't break the pattern of eating. We need to eat. And we can't even break the pattern of food tendency. But we can decide to fill our stomachs with specific health-promoting foods. Right?
Yes.
And that's a lot of what we try to do through a lot of the golden nuggets that we teach is we're trying to inch people closer to that point, to that understanding that we can't necessarily change the fact that we need to eat, so you have to eat, and we can't necessarily change the tendency, what we are drawn to, but we can make decisions. And that's what you're talking about with willpower, is using, you know, a part of your brain that's responsible for deciding, for making decisions, and using it to direct you towards a specific path, right?
Yes, that's absolutely what I'm talking about.
Okay, good. So food tendency, if I had to define that, it's what we naturally, and when I say naturally, basically from a genetic or instinctual perspective, okay, the types of foods that we gravitate towards. Okay.
Are you talking about like some people like salty foods, some people like sweet food? Is that the thing you're talking about?
Well, you know, salty foods is, you know, we do have a tendency to crave salty foods, especially when we need it. So if we're dehydrated, we will crave salty things, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what you said about sweets, that is more what I'm focused on today.
Okay.
We are hardwired, okay? And it's not just sweets. We're hardwired to eat energy-dense foods. Okay, what is an energy-dense food?
Energy-dense, I would say, is calorie-dense food, like peanut butter.
Right.
Cheese,
yep. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just trying to come up with fatty things. I'm trying to come up with something that is very small but contains – oh, fudge.
Fudge.
How about fudge? I mean, is that like the most packed with sugar thing out there or what? Mm-hmm. Sodas, I would say, would probably mm-hmm. be one. Yep.
So those are all really good examples of what would be an energy-dense food. To define it, an energy-dense food would be a food that was high in calories for the quantity of food that you get. The reason you
so list not those filling. Things,
mm-hmm. Right. You know, the reason you list those specific foods are because there are a lot of calories in a small little package, right?
Yes.
And so that's what we mean by food tendency. We naturally, from a genetic and instinctual perspective, we gravitate towards foods that are high in calories in small packages.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, we've always loved and craved high-calorie foods. The problem is availability of those high-calorie foods. So like a lot of people, you know, we're talking a lot about the Paleolithic lifestyle. And, you know, we hear a lot about how that's a good lifestyle to pursue. If you're looking to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
But what most people don't realize is that our cave-dwelling ancestors weren't fat because they knew some weight loss secret, right?
Right.
They were fit and trim because they had no choice. Our problem isn't the fact that we have that food exists. Our problem is that we have a choice as to whether or not we can eat it.
You know? Right. Like we talked about it a long time ago. You can reach from the couch probably to the cupboard and grab a bag of chips. There's no motivator. There's no energy being spent to yes. grab those calorie-dense foods.
Right. You know, if a cave person, a caveman or woman were to go out looking for food and they were to wander across an apple in the ground, they mm-hmm. might have spent 200 calories in energy in order to eat an apple or to find an apple that...
That's like 80 calories.
Yeah.
Right.
So, that's the secret of our cave-dwelling ancestors, is it was they weren't fat because they had some secret, some weight loss secret. They were fit and trim only because they really had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
If they did have a choice, if they had tons of animals to hunt and they could eat animals with every meal, they probably would have, and they probably would have gotten fat, and they probably would have loved it.
Yeah.
You know?
They would have been known as the rich people, right?
That's right.
Amongst their buddies.
Exactly. That's right. And we can get into a whole discussion about from a genetic perspective, how that our capacity to store fat is what's responsible, you know, for the survival of the individuals during that time period,
mm-hmm.
so that every single one of us is really good at storing fat to some on some level. If we weren't, we would not, you know, basically be here because the people
we would not have survived.
Right, the people whose bodies were not good at storing fat would have died off.
Right.
Right.
Okay, I don't want to get us totally off topic, but I do have a question that's related to what we were just talking about with children and eating, chicken and pizza, chicken nuggets and pizza and French fries and stuff like that. So can I ask a question? Can I intervene here?
Of course.
Okay, it's going to lead us down the right path, I think.
Okay.
We're going to progress. I don't think we're backstepping. Kids nowadays, more so than like kids our days, okay, let's say I'm almost 37. All right, you and I are really close in age, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're really close in age. So say 25 years ago, I think the processed foods that were available, there were very few drive-thrus, and I lived in Portland, Oregon, so it was in a big town. It's not like, you know, there wasn't fast food joints around. They were just not on every street corner.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't eat like that very often. Do you think there is a difference between children today, 20 years from now, storing fat or having an ability to store fat more readily than, say, people from our era.
Oh, yeah. You know, I would say absolutely. And I think I think it's exposure. It's number of times that we're exposed to these things. Like when you and I were growing up, when we went to McDonald's, it was a treat.
Oh, right? Yeah. Heck yeah.
And it wasn't
like once every 3 months. Yeah.
I'm 36. You're 36, right?
I'll be 37 at the end of the month. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it wasn't really that long ago, but even within that short period of time, how many times do parents bring their kids to fast food restaurants?
Yeah, I know. And twice a week. Now, I mean, I'm talking about these days, like I've got friends that 2 or 3 days a week, right, they take their kids to drive through. So are we setting a stage for a major fat problem later? Are we setting these kids up major fat storage problems?
It's already here. It's already here. Now, from a genetic perspective, you don't change genetically that quickly. So they're basically working with the same genes that we have. The difference is the environment. Okay, the environment that they're living in is more calorie dense, and it speaks directly to the topic that we're talking about here. The problem is how much calorie dense foods are available. When we were growing up, yeah, they were out there. Yeah, McDonald's was there, but the serving sizes weren't as large. Mm-hmm. You know, 7-Eleven really, really took that to a whole new level. And that was happening just as we were entering into like our teen years, and we started to see the big gulps and the
super Slurpees super and all that stuff.
Yeah. McDonald's was supersizing their food. You know, we were around before supersizing. And then supersizing hit, and then supersizing was removed from McDonald's. But it doesn't stop people from getting, consuming large quantities of food. And this is the problem. The problem is availability of these foods. Okay?
Okay.
So I think we're going to get into what I feel is probably the biggest problem, and this basically goes to or speaks to our children's issues as well as our own. Okay? The body determines food preferences by basically how many neurotransmitters are released in response to food, which is determined by what do you think it is? What do you think it is that determines how many and what types of neurotransmitters are produced by our brain?
Yeah, the way it tastes to you?
Yes.
No.
No, that's true. And what determines how it
probably tastes? The pleasure that you get from that particular item, the sugar.
Right. So what determines how good a food tastes?
Oh, the sugar, the fat.
The calorie density.
Yeah, the flavor. Yeah.
How much sugar and how much
the enjoyment that you get from that. And the more dense it is, the more enjoyment you get.
Well, then you start running into the chicken and the egg, because the reason you get the pleasure is because of the neurotransmitters. So if we speak specifically to the question of what causes our body to produce the neurotransmitters that make us feel that degree of pleasure, it is the calorie density of the food. Let me give you an example, okay? I'll give you an example of how this works. If we eat a Cinnabon, okay, for
how many calories? I love Cinnabon. Oh, no. I don't. 800.
Do you think are 8? Good. This is a good example here because it's 750 plus. So you called that without even having to look it up. I had to look it up. But that is how calibrated you are to the calorie content of various foods.
Is that with or without the extra frosting?
It has enough frosting as it comes. Now,
I don't know
if they have Cinnabons in Europe or we have them here in the States. It's basically this small restaurant that produces these humongous cinnamon buns.
Oh, and they are absolutely delicious, but horrible for you.
They were made in a laboratory. They were designed in a laboratory to cause you to become addicted to them. But that's a whole
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
So if we eat a Cinnabon, that's 750 calories per bun, okay?
Okay.
Our reward centers literally light up similarly to someone who just snorted cocaine.
Okay.
Okay, in essence, there's little difference between a brain of somebody who just had a Cinnabon and someone who just snorted cocaine.
Okay, I believe that.
When your brain lights up to that extent, it basically tags that food as an extremely desirable or pleasurable food, right?
Okay, makes so much sense.
Okay, so let's kind of take a natural example. You know, what would nature provide as a Cinnabon? Well, if we looked at a strawberry, You know, how many calories do you think is in a cup of strawberries?
Oh, 40?
40, yep, 40 calories. Okay, so strawberries do cause the same reward center in your brain to light up, except it's not nearly to the same extent as a Cinnabon. If,
right.
You know, if we took a functional image of the brain on a Cinnabon, it would look like a bonfire compared to the activity that would be triggered by eating, let's say, you know, a quarter cup or half a cup of strawberries, which mm-hmm. would look more like a Zippo lighter. So,
right.
Same brain region, different level of activation. Are you getting this?
Yeah.
Okay, so the strawberries, if we were living out in nature and all we had was strawberries and oranges and fruit, okay, mm-hmm. we would get a high degree of pleasure from eating that fruit because that was the only thing that we were exposed to.
Because it's all relative.
Because a Cinnabon doesn't exist.
Right.
Right? It's all relative.
So,
this also explains why artificial sweeteners are so enticing to us as well. They trick the brain into thinking you just ate something extremely high in calories, right?
And why we keep graduating to more processed and worse for you foods or the availability of these things.
Right.
Wow.
So you said it's all
relative.
Relative. Okay.
It is relative.
So this brings us to our first kind of key point of today's discussion. It's what I call the food desire continuum, okay?
Okay.
So besides the neurotransmitters, the blood nutrients and the hormones also play a role in food preference. So when you eat a particular food, your brain listens to the chatter that's going on between the food and your cells, right? And this chatter is the hormones that enter into the blood in response to foods that you eat. You know, a good example of this would be like insulin, which tells your body that a high density food or high calorie food is on its way into your blood.
Mm-hmm.
So this chatter basically helps to signify to the brain that you've had enough to eat, right?
Okay. Yep.
And we know that insulin has a satiety effect. When your insulin levels go up from basically eating carbohydrates, then it causes you to feel satiated, at least in a healthy body. In an unhealthy body, does that same thing hold true?
No, you would have totally mixed signals. You probably would never feel satiated.
Right.
Because your body's just so out of balance.
You have plenty of insulin, but you also have insulin resistance.
Yes.
So the insulin can't signify to the body that you've eaten something. It's pumping out the hormone. It's doing what it's supposed to do, but the hormone can't convey its message.
Right.
Okay. So this brings us to what I call the density to desire continuum, okay? And this is really a theoretical model, Blythe. It's not meant to be, because I don't actually have numbers. You know, I can't say that this food has this desire to density ratio number, okay?
Okay.
But just think of this discussion in terms of philosophy, all right, or thought process or framework, okay? So look at food density as occurring on a continuum. And each food has a density to desire score, which would be calculated by some imaginary formula. As I mentioned, I don't have numbers. Okay, this is an imaginary formula.
Okay, we can play.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, thank you. It basically takes into account how many calories a food has by how much we desire it. Okay?
Okay.
So a bad food would have a high desire score and a high calorie density score.
Okay.
Okay. So by this example, a salad would have a very low score, right?
Unless it's a salad that you really, really enjoy.
Right.
Right?
Which is fairly rare. People oftentimes do, you know, there are people who like salads, but not to the extent that you would get the same level of desire or craving as you would, say, a Cinnabon or a chocolate bar.
Okay.
Or,
okay. You know, I think we would probably 80% of the population would choose dessert over a healthy meal.
98.
Okay. Okay. I didn't hit that one on the nose, but
maybe even 100%. I mean, that type of desire, that craving for high density foods, it may not come in the form of sweet. It may come in the form of fat. You know, like when we ask for calorie dense foods, what kinds of foods did you start off saying?
Oh, cheese and peanut butter, buffalo wings. Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's calorie density. Fat is in fact the most calorie dense source, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a Cinnabon cinnamon roll would have a very high score due to the fact that it contains tons of fat and carbs It's extremely flavorful.
And do you know the breakdown of that?
No,
I know you said you looked it up, but you didn't look up
the breakdown. No, I just looked at the calories for the example.
I'm just going to guess. And you guys can go, I'll look this up after. I'm going to say there's like 60 grams of fat in one of those. I'm just going to guess.
Okay, good. I'm going to write that down. We'll check it at the end of the podcast.
That'd be 540 of the 800 calories or 750 calories. That might be a little high, but still. That'd be 540 of those calories would come from fat.
Yeah, that's good. You want to give me a range? Let's say
between like 48 and 60.
48 to 60. Okay. I was totally impressed with the fact that you came up with 800 calories right off the bat like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we know that if we're looking at calorie density, the density to desire score, salad, very low. It's low in calories. It's low in desire. Like, you may enjoy a salad, but you're not going to enjoy it to the same level that you would a Cinnabon or a chocolate bar or things like that. So that's the difference. Okay. And I want to point out that this isn't based on my own thought process. This is actually based on research from Tufts University and Dr. Susan Roberts at Tufts University here in the States. Okay, so imagine that you're a vegetarian and you live off of fruits and vegetables. Okay. Salad would receive, let's say, a score of 1, right? Well, a mango, which is considered one of the sweetest fruits available in nature, could receive a score of 10 on this imaginary continuum.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so you're a vegetarian. You don't eat the junk. You live primarily off of vegetation. Okay, so let's say that anything above the halfway mark on this continuum would leave you feeling satiated. So if you eat something like a bowl of just lettuce, it probably is going to be a 1 or a 2 on that scale, right?
Okay, yeah.
It's not going to leave you feeling satiated like you would if you had like a tasty treat of some sort.
Okay.
So if you were to eat a strawberry, given that that's your continuum, 1 to 10, basically the least sweet thing you eat is lettuce. The most sweet thing you typically eat is some sort of fruit, and that fruit has a score of 10. If you were to eat a strawberry, it would probably fall somewhere at a 7 or an 8, right?
I was going to say 7 or 8, yeah.
Okay, good. Between, let's say, a salad and mango, which is one of the sweetest fruits available. And so if you were to eat strawberries, that may satiate you, right? That may satisfy you. You may not have cravings once you ate the strawberries, right? In essence, you'd feel like you had a dessert.
Yes.
Is that you? Do you feel like you have a dessert when you have fruit?
No. I have to be honest. I'm a regular person. No, I feel like I've had dessert if I eat a piece of cheesecake or Oreo cookies or something like that, like something that is totally calorie dense and dessertful. But I limit myself to those experiences. And I think that's the category I fall into, is just a constant awareness.
Well, thank you for being honest. I would say the same thing about me. Now I'm going to tell you why that is.
Okay.
So imagine that you worked in the mall, okay? Let's say you worked in Columbia Mall, which is a mall around here. Uh-huh. And you passed by a Cinnabon restaurant on your way to work every morning.
Okay.
You decide one day that you're going to have a Cinnabon. You're this vegetarian who's never had anything but salad and fruit, okay?
Okay.
You decide one day that you're going to have a Cinnabon, and you fall instantly in love with it, as many people do.
You don't even care if you're a vegetarian anymore. It's all about the Cinnabon now.
Okay. By the way, interesting point. You know, when they build their Cinnabon, they're like these little tiny, almost kiosk restaurants in most malls.
They remind me of Great American Cookie kiosks. Uh-huh.
Exactly. You know, they would literally want to, they would not want to be in the food court. And they specifically designed it this way. They designed it to place them in other areas of the mall, usually around corners, so that the smell would waft and wouldn't compete with other smells from other restaurants, would waft down the hallway so that as people are walking up to the restaurant or walking closer to the restaurant, they start to smell the Cinnabon. So now they start to crave it. And then by the time they pass it, they find themselves walking and standing in line, not realizing why they all of a sudden crave a Cinnabon. That's right. Why. So they literally designed it that way. And this is how a lot of companies do it. That's just a side note.
It's part of their marketing tactic. You know, they just put one in by me. I have not seen a Cinnabon in Florida yet, but they just built one about 2 months ago. It's down the road.
It's the perfect business because once people have it, it's like I say, it's like cocaine.
It just catches fire. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so now our vegetarian friend decides to have their Cinnabon. They fall in love with it, as so many other people do. Then over the coming months, you start to eat them more and more often, right? Mm-hmm. Now, instead of getting it just that one time, let's say one time a week, you start to get it twice a week and then three times a week.
Okay.
So now you've been exposed to the Cinnabon. And let's say for our purposes that a Cinnabon in comparison to the mango has a score of 100, right? So now you've basically reset the scale of the continuum. Now, instead of going from 1 to 10, which is where you were living when you were eating salad and strawberries, or salad and mangoes, it now goes from 1 to 100, okay? So now that's what your brain is calibrated for. Okay. So now that strawberry or that mango that was once so satisfying to you, for all intents and purposes, is as unsatisfying as a salad.
Okay.
So now you may have to turn to baked goods in order to feel like you've had dessert, when before you would have felt like it was okay to have a cup of strawberries. Mm-hmm. Now you don't feel satisfied until you have a cookie or a piece of cake.
Okay. I totally get that.
Okay. So that is, I think, once you understand the machinery of how this works, you start to be able to change course, right? Because you understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's jump into the action steps. Like, how do we use this concept of the density to desire continuum? How do we use it? All right. So we're going to get into the action steps. I'm going to go ahead and list them off. So how you guys can use this information. Okay. Step number one is to define low-calorie foods in terms of calories per ounce.
Okay, so find foods that you like that you know are not calorie dense.
Right. So when you're talking about, like most people, they define low calorie foods in terms of specific things. Like they may say, okay, hamburgers are high calorie food. Mm-hmm. By that definition, we might label a low calorie food as, let's say a turkey sandwich.
Okay. Right? Okay.
Or a turkey burger. Okay, that might they may call a low calorie food, but what they're suggesting, this again was from the work of Tufts University. Tufts University defines a low calorie food as 40 calories per ounce of food. You see how that works?
Oh, okay. So there's a little okay.
So we start looking at food in terms of calories per ounce, which speaks to calorie density. That is far better of an approach to defining what a low calorie food is.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think that the key to getting people to remember that they enjoy these types of foods are actually going back to eating them too. You know, pick the foods that you actually enjoy, you know, that you know are healthy for you, and you will get to the point where you enjoy them again. You kind of bring that level of the Cinnabon being 100 back into perspective of your 1 to 10. And I'm not saying life has to be boring, but there are great tasting, natural, healthy foods out there that don't make you feel horrible after you eat them. And this was a huge turning point in my life. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But it's just a whole nother level of awareness. Be aware of what's in the food that you're choosing and how dense the calories are.
And it starts with how you define calorie density. And that's the big factor here. So in this case, we're talking about defining calorie density in terms of calories per ounce. When you start to look at food in that way, it is a cool way of looking at it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so some examples. Fruit and vegetables would be approximately, dependent upon the fruit and vegetable, 8 to 16 calories per ounce. If we were to list all the fruits and vegetables together, it'd be, 8 to 16 calories per ounce, okay?
Okay.
Nuts and chips would be 155 to 165 calories per ounce. So you start to see how something like nuts would not be considered a low-calorie food, although many people might consider it one, right?
Right. A lot of people choose to eat almonds or something throughout the day as a snack, thinking that they're not getting a lot of calories, where in fact they are calorie dense.
Right. And so you've got to be careful with those foods. They are.
I'm not saying that nuts aren't good. Right. I'm not saying that nuts aren't good. Don't get me wrong. But if you're going for a light, low calorie, less calorie dense food, nuts should not be one of the first things you think about.
Right. You got to take it in the context of your entire diet. Can you have a handful of nuts a day? Sure. Mm-hmm. But do you want to eat them as every snack, like a lot of people do?
Yeah.
The answer is probably no, based on the calorie density of the food, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So to drive the point home, if we were to take whole wheat flour, and I gave this example on our Facebook page, which if you haven't checked it out, it's at Cut the Fat Podcast, all one word. Search us out and be sure to like our page. But I gave this example. 1 cup of whole wheat flour contains almost 500 calories.
Mm-hmm. 1 cup.
1 cup of whole wheat flour, enriched whole wheat flour.
Just now, picture a measuring cup. I mean, that's not – that would fit in the palm of your hand.
Exactly. Now let's compare it to the same amount, 1 cup of spinach. How many calories are in 1 cup of spinach?
Oh, 30 maybe?
7.
Okay. See, I wasn't right on the nose with that. I'm thinking you got to pack it down. No.
Wait a minute. Teasing. Wait a minute, Blythe. How do you know the calorie content of a Cinnabon, but you don't know the calorie content of spinach?
You know
– because you don't care about it.
You know what? That's true because – I look at donuts and Cinnabons and things like that, that I love those type of foods, but I know how horrible they make me feel. And I know what is not what the ingredients are, but I know what happens to my body when I eat them. And that is my deterrent. That's the rule that I've made for myself, that I choose not to eat stuff like that because I don't want the things that happen to my body happening. I don't want all the repercussions from that. It's not worth it to me.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, spinach, you don't have that same kind of worry. So
not at all.
You know in your brain that you could literally eat a whole bag of spinach and not have to worry about it. It's considered, it's what we would label a negative calorie food, meaning your body probably has to expend more energy to pull calories out of spinach
right.
than it gets from eating the spinach.
Yeah. Yeah. Celery is another one of those, you know.
Mm-hmm. Cucumbers, another mm-hmm. good example. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, meant as a guideline. Remember, this is a continuum. So if a food contains 50 calories per ounce, that is a lot better than one that contains 80 calories per ounce, which is far better than one that contains 100 calories per ounce. So I don't want to say that you can only eat foods that are 40 calories per ounce. What we're saying is look at it as a continuum. Start thinking in terms of how a food in calories per ounce rather than just calories, right?
That's a great guideline. That's a whole nother way. It's a whole nother perspective.
And as I mentioned, just to give credit where credit's due, that comes from Tufts University. That's not my own making, okay?
Yeah, that's great.
All right, let's go on to the second one, which is start by freeing yourself from the grip of calorie-dense foods. Okay, so basically we're given, like you mentioned when we were talking about defining the calories, you mentioned how what this was all about. Basically, what we're doing through these action steps is giving you a step-by-step guideline for how to go from having all these major cravings for these calorie-dense foods to once again restoring your taste for lower calorie-dense foods.
Mm-hmm. Just moving back down the scale.
You got it. So tell us about this. You know, what do we mean by start by freeing yourself from the grip of calorie-dense foods? How would you do that?
Well, whenever I work with clients, especially doing nutritional stuff, if I'm helping people, I ask them where they start, okay? Because you never know if you're starting with somebody who's like the vegetarian that we spoke of earlier, who eats anywhere between lettuce and mangoes, or you're working with somebody who eats McDonald's for breakfast, you know, sausage McBiscuit or whatever, and they finish off the day with a pizza. So the guidelines for those two types of individuals would be completely different. But what I always say is you have to work your way backward. Okay. So if you're somebody who eats processed food morning till night, well, we're going to start implementing some natural foods in there. From there, we're going to start now after we've implemented something new and natural, you're going to say, oh, well, that's something new and it actually tastes good. Wow. So these people are more open to wanting to try something else. So now we can maybe take out the sausage McBiscuit in the morning and replace it with maybe oatmeal with some natural brown sugar or, you know, something that's more towards the natural side. So we're slowly restoring, moving backwards down the scale, trying to get rid of those, you know, the big fires that are set off like when you eat a Cinnabon mm-hmm. every time you eat these foods. So we're implementing healthier versions. So it's a lateral shift in the in the right direction.
Right. Well, you know, the lateral shifts we're going to get into here a little bit later, but you know, at this stage in the plan, what we want to do, what I've found is that once you have built your continuum, once you've had the Cinnabon, now your continuum goes from 1 to 100. Mm-hmm. So it's oftentimes a good idea for people to do, you know, what you oftentimes hear described as cleansing, right? Basically, where you cut out energy-dense foods that are excessively sweet, starchy, or buttery, okay? You start cutting out artificial sweeteners, mm-hmm. and you basically take the hit. You know, you're going to suffer some sort of...
Are you saying cold turkey?
I'm saying for a couple of days, if you really want to get a grip on this, if you're really addicted to these foods, you almost have to take this time to push through and cut those foods out so that we can reset the clock, reset the continuum scale, basically.
Okay, well, let me just intervene here real quick, because let's just take, for instance, a bodybuilder. I'm always bringing bodybuilders into it, but let's say somebody wants to diet for the next 12 weeks and they want to be as lean and as ripped as they can be. The first move that person makes is cutting out those types of things from their diets. And it really does take, if you can give yourself 4 or 5 days, sometimes a week, you kind of get rid of that carb cloud, like that sugar cloud, mm-hmm. and you start to feel better once you make it over that hump, because to some degree, we all really are addicted to sugar. So when the Atkins diet came out, and you could eat as much protein and as much fat as you wanted, but you're cutting out the carbs. It's still the same idea, but not to the extreme. And not saying you can eat as much fat as you want either, because that may be neither here nor there, but that is calorie dense and we're not talking about that. But the idea was that you feel more satiated by having all the fats and the proteins.
And that was the whole purpose of the induction phase mm-hmm. of the Atkins program, was to break that hold that these foods have on you. And it really does suck for the first couple of days.
It's really tough. And I don't care if you're starting from where I'm at today, where I'm sort of at a maintenance phase, you know, I'm comfortable with where I'm at. I don't eat perfectly all day, every day, but I start my days very healthy. And if I have dessert, maybe, you know, a few times a week. So I do go off plan sometimes, but I know you hate this word moderation, but I keep it in moderation. I'm at like a happy medium right now.
But by moderation, you don't actually eat small amounts of them every day. What you do is you may have a dessert.
It's like an allowance.
The next day, what do you end up doing? You end up doing the same thing that we're recommending here, which is you don't eat those foods for mm-hmm. a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if I were to wean myself off the sugars completely, it would suck for a few days. I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm. That is one of the toughest parts. And I'm not saying everybody out there has to suffer, but try it. Put yourself to the test. Right. You'll see if you're addicted to sugar, if you eat any processed foods, if you are not that vegetarian where the strawberry or the mango is your 10, you're probably addicted to sugar and or processed foods and or artificial sweeteners, sweets, generally speaking.
Right.
And calorie dense, carbohydrate, fatty, sugary foods.
What we're recommending you do here by doing this quote unquote cleansing of calorie dense foods. We're not talking about cleansing in terms of taking bunches of herbs and, you know, drinking all kinds of salt water and lemon juice and things like that. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to consciously decide on your continuum scale, right? Realize that foods that you eat today will impact foods that you will feel satisfied by tomorrow. And that's the point.
That's a golden nugget right there. Sometimes I love the words that are coming out of your mouth. They make so much sense to me. That really makes so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it does to me as well. And I think you're right. I think that is a key point. That's one you've got to really take home, is that what you eat today will impact the foods that you will feel satisfied by tomorrow. Okay.
And as you become healthier and fitter and feeling better, that's going to remind your body that those are the foods that you want to be choosing. It works perfectly.
Yep. And it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be all the time. Like you perform, Blythe, when you go out and you eat a dessert, you unconsciously will take a couple days where you're not eating that type of food. Mm-hmm. And so you're basically, you may reset your continuum there to a higher level for a day, But over the next couple days, you're going to find that you're resetting it back to a lower level. Now, it may not be 1 to 10 like the lettuce and strawberries, but it may be 1 to 20, right?
Right.
It's not living. You're not living in the world of 1 to 100 on that scale, because it's nearly impossible to feel satiated by anything but baked goods and sweets at that point.
It's too big of a trap, and I choose not to climb out of that trap all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So think, it helps to think how a food will reset your density to desire scale. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at a particular food, ask yourself, how is this going to reset my density to desire scale? Is it going to move my from 1 to 20? Now I'm going to have to live in between 1 and 100 for a while? And maybe that'll help you make better choices.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Love it. This is a great topic.
Oh, thank you.
I'm getting all pumped up.
Let's go on to the next step.
Okay.
This is a fast one. Okay. This is not going to take us long to discuss, but I think it's so crucially important. Okay. And that is accept the core truth. All right. And that is this, folks. Yeah. I love you guys, but I got to be straight up honest with you. We call this what? Tough love. Okay.
Yes.
You will always crave calorie dense food. It's hardwired. There is no secret to never wanting those types of food in your life.
That's right. That's right.
You will always crave calorie-dense foods. You'll always want to eat the Cinnabon over the bowl of lettuce.
Still thinking about the Cinnabon.
Yeah. You know why? You know why I chose that one?
Why?
Because I think when you were competing, correct me if I'm wrong, when you were competing, and I think all bodybuilders do this. They have leading up to the competition, the bodybuilding competition.
The one food that would just do it all for you.
You're so strict with your diet for three weeks. You're totally strict, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the bodybuilding competition comes. You go through it, and it's over. And practically everybody I see, after watching the competition, I see family members running up with boxes of donuts and things like that.
Oh yeah.
Your one food was a Cinnabon, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. I haven't had one since.
Yeah,
it's it's dangerous. It's dangerous because I'm a food addict. And if I know what will happen, then I'll say, oh, well, that wasn't that bad. You know, I'm just like everybody else out there. I just have an awareness that is right in front of me all the time that weighs the pros and cons. And I know how I'll feel. It's like buyer's remorse.
Yes.
You know, except it's eater's remorse. Maybe that's my new word. Eater's remorse.
Eater's remorse. I like that. You just coined that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, you can't eliminate cravings for high carb, energy dense foods. That's what I'm trying to tell people. But you can turn down the volume.
Yes.
By defining your density to desire continuum. That's what we're talking about here. Is we're talking about changing or decreasing or turning down the volume of these cravings that we're talking about.
Yeah, and the less you eat of them, the less. I'm not going to say the less your craving becomes, but the less you feel like you have to feed that craving, like the intensity of the craving goes down.
Right. And you start to taste foods differently as well. You know, I remember.
Yes.
I remember watching a TV show called Freaky Eaters. And on there, the nutritionist was given the woman who the show was about. A bowl. She blindfolded her and gave her a bunch of different foods to taste, one of which was a mango, which she listed as one of the sweetest foods available, one of the sweetest fruits available in nature. And she's like, what does this taste like? Because she couldn't see what food she was eating. Mm-hmm. And she says, tastes like nothing. I don't know what this is. It's nasty. It's slimy. It has no taste. And she's like, take your blindfold off. She says, that's a mango you just ate. You just ate a mango, one of nature's most sweetest fruits, and you couldn't taste it.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that. You know, there's this hormone, leptin, in the body that interferes with our taste. So what ends up happening is when we eat all this junky food, then because we have this leptin resistance, food no longer – it takes the taste of food down a couple notches. Mm-hmm. So you start to need sweeter and sweeter and tastier foods before you actually taste things.
Right.
So you're satiated by – and that's a good example as to why this continuum is really the truth of how our brain works with food. Okay?
That's a great example.
All right, so that was accept the truth, and the truth is you will always crave calorie-dense foods. There's no secret coming around the corner. Or there's no fitness guru, no weight loss guru that's going to come around the corner and teach you some sort of magic trick that prevents those cravings from – prevents you from feeling those cravings. Those cravings will be with you forever. The difference is we can turn the volume down by following these steps, okay?
That's empowering to know.
All right, and let's go to the next one, which is eat. For goodness sake, people, eat. You have to eat.
Right? Do not starve yourselves. I know. I feel like getting the stick and beating people. You have to eat. If you don't eat, you will slow your metabolism down. And that is what we are always talking about. You want to keep that fire burning. You want to the ultimate, if you were at the perfect weight, you looked exactly what you wanted to look like. The ultimate goal should be get as much of what you enjoy eating in, and I'm not talking about Cinnabons, okay? The foods that you enjoy that you know are healthy for you, getting as much of that in and still be comfortable or still be losing or still be working towards your goal. So by not eating, you're hindering that process. It's wasting days. It's wasting time. By not eating, you're slowing the process. And I don't think anybody here wants to slow the process of weight loss.
Right. And it's hardwired. The need for food is hardwired. So there's no way for you to beat out that hardwiring with software. You can't say to yourself, okay, I could just not eat and I'll be able to manage this forever. Eventually, the desire for eat takes over your body and you have to start eating. And that's why people binge. Binging is such a big factor right now.
So start sharing that with all your friends. You must eat.
Yes.
I would like it to be like a world-renowned podcast. They said you must eat, and all of a sudden everybody starts to, you know, starts eating and slimming down. It happens. You know what?
I'd love for that to be the case.
You know what? Let me just give you an example. I have a client that I'm working with right now. She's like 10 pounds heavier than she wants to be. Now, she's competed before. She's done it with help every time. And she said, I just can't lose these extra 10 pounds. Can I start logging my food? And can you start looking at it? We made a couple of changes. And number one is the accountability, because she knows I'm looking at her food. Number two, we made a couple of very, very simple changes, and she lost 7 pounds in 2 weeks. She's already almost at her goal. The problem was she's active. She's a busy person. She's working all the time. She's under a lot of stress. She wasn't eating enough. And I'm telling you that I bumped her calories up by like 300. And I'm not saying everybody go out there and eat junk. These are the right type of calories. She wasn't getting enough to feed her body so it would be comfortable enough to lose the weight. So there's a little bit to be learned from that, I think. It's people who are active and they can't figure out why they just can't lose and they're doing 3 hours of cardio every day. Make sure you're getting in enough of the right types of calories so your body is comfortable losing.
Absolutely. Very good point. I love to hear those examples too, because I think that drives the point home. I have similar examples, but it really would be redundant for me to give my examples because it's the same story.
I know we want to talk about our clients all the time.
Yeah.
It's fun to share those stories.
So what about this, Blythe? Many people eat less throughout the day so that they can kind of rationalize the consumption of like energy-dense foods later. Like they say, I haven't eaten all day, so it's okay if I order a bowl of spaghetti and eat a loaf of bread. You know, how's that? Does that work out?
Common misconception. No, because... Okay, say you are driving a car and you've got $5, and we all know that $5 doesn't get you very far these days. Would you fill up your gas tank right before you park the car in the garage for the night, or would you fill up the gas tank before you have to run around and do everything you need to do that day? Well, I think for all of us who don't want to run out of gas, we'd probably fill it up before we go do the things we need to do. And it's the same with calories. Fill your body. Breakfast should be the biggest or one of the biggest meals of the day, because you've got the next 10 or 12 hours or however long you stay up to burn those calories off. So no, it should be flip-flopped. Dinner should not be the biggest meal of the day. It should be breakfast, because you don't want to fill up your gas tank right before you go to bed.
Yeah, and you're most insulin sensitive in the morning, so that's when you should be getting any carbs you consume.
That's right.
So calorically, it works out, though. You know, calorically, if we were to do the numbers, you know, you can do that, and it will work out calorically. Trust me, the brain accepts this argument with little debate, because, you know, you want to eat these foods. You know, but remember, by eating that dense food, you just set the highest point of your continuum with that meal. Now it will be harder to feel satisfied by other healthy meals later on, right?
Yes.
Goes back to the point number, what was that, number two?
Yes.
One of those points. Okay. One of those points. It was number two or number three, I can't recall. Anyway, but that's the point, is that you cannot just store up all of your calories and then expect to eat calorie-dense foods like a Cinnabon later in the day.
Right.
Like we say, it works out from a numbers perspective, but you've just reset your continuum to a higher level. So now the following meal or the following day, you're going to require much sweeter, much more flavorful foods in order to feel satiated. Okay?
Right. It was number three, just so you know, accept the truth.
Okay, accept the truth. Got it. Make lateral shifts with your treats. Okay, so this is the next step. Make lateral shifts with your treats. When you do decide to indulge, okay, this is the point. When you do decide to indulge, choose the least sweet that you can eat. How's that? I made that one up. That's it kind of rhymes. Choose the least sweet that you can eat.
Okay.
And still basically have that itch scratched. Basically, we're trying to choose the least sweet food that will scratch the itch that we have to eat something sweet.
Okay. Well, give me an example. I want to hear what one of your examples would be.
Okay. So if we, let's say we're craving a sweet dessert. Okay. And, normally we would go out and buy Cinnabon. Okay. We don't necessarily need that degree of sweetness in order to achieve the same, to basically have our itch scratched. We might say, okay, well, maybe a scoop of, let's say a scoop of ice cream would do.
Okay.
So that's a lateral shift. So we've gone from a Cinnabon of 750 calories to a scoop of ice cream that may have 200 calories.
Okay. See, I love this because you're still... This doesn't scare people away. Lateral shifts don't scare people away. There is nothing on this earth that is scarier than somebody telling you you can never eat that again. Mm-hmm. That's the worst. I mean, I think we all are hardwired to eat. And if somebody tells you, well, you can never eat chocolate again, I would probably just jump off a bridge.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You can... make those lateral shifts. And I love that.
And, you know, the point here is not that you should, I'm not going out and recommending people eat ice cream.
No.
What I'm recommending is that you make lateral shifts and you continue to do so. So after you move from the Cinnabon to a scoop of ice cream that goes from 750 calories down to 200 calories, then.
And now the ice cream satiates you.
Right. So now you've brought your scale down from 1 to 100 down to 1 to 70, let's say. Mm-hmm. Now we can take and we can do another lateral shift, right?
How about like a homemade smoothie?
So now you've moved from the ice cream to the smoothie, and that may bring you down to 1 in 20, right?
Yeah.
1 to 20.
So you that's can use how, real fruit and
yes, exactly.
That's how you do it, folks.
That's how you do it. Okay, so that's the lateral shifts. That's what we mean by lateral shifts. Anything else to say on that topic? Do you have any other examples you want to give or anything you want to...
Of lateral shifts? Lateral shifts?
It's pretty cut and dry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm trying to think of what... Well, you know, probably the first lateral shift I ever made, and this is after I made the big discovery of, wow, donuts make me feel horrible. I think donuts were the one target food that I went... I just felt horrible after eating that. I'm never going to eat a donut again. So now every time my kids love donuts, every time I take them, I remember how horrible that felt. It's like a non-smoker smoking a cigarette. It was horrible. You know, I don't want to eat that anymore. And I've convinced myself, as good as it might taste, I remember how yucky that was. So I try to use that as a reminder every time I, you know, think about Cinnabons. Thanks, Ray. Anytime I think about stuff like that, you know, that it really doesn't make me feel well, although it may taste good for the 10 minutes and it might make me feel great for the 10 minutes that I eat it. I all of a sudden get the eater's remorse and it physically drags me down. It doesn't make me feel well. And where was I going with that? Oh, lateral shifts. I forgot where I was going with that, but the big awareness of Oh, I know what I was saying. Sorry. The first lateral shift I ever made was going from like regular breakfast foods to eating those pancakes, those oatmeal pancakes. We've got a little video on YouTube. And that's something I pretty much eat every day because I like them. So the key is finding things you really, really enjoy that also make you feel great. And lateral shifts are how you find those things. And you have to be creative.
So choose the least sweet sweet that you can eat.
There you go.
All right. And then continue to do so. Continue to do so. You slowly chip away at that until you're eating, you know, as natural food as humanly possible and still feel good about it, right? Yeah. The point is that as we get closer to that realm where fruit is a dessert for us, then we no longer begin to feel like we're losing something. You know, if we go from Cinnabon to trying to eat strawberries, we feel like we're losing something.
Right.
But when we make these lateral shifts and continue to do so, we decrease the impact that that has on us. So it turns the volume down.
Love it. I think that was a great topic today.
Good. Well, we're almost done. We still got two more points left.
Oh, okay.
That's the next one is to put the dessert in the middle of the meal. Again, this one comes from Dr. Susan Roberts of Tufts University, author of the book The I Diet, and she calls this the sandwich method.
Okay.
What you do is you eat your salad at the beginning, having your highest density to desire food, and then you finish with something less with a low density to desire ratio. Okay, so we go from a salad, we might have our dessert, and then we might finish with something that would be a low density food. So we end the meal with the memory of the lower density to desire food. Okay.
I don't know if I like that one.
You know what? I'm not sure that I do either, but I wanted to throw it out there as an option. And
hey, it might work for some. I think I would just skip dessert altogether if that were the case. So, hey, that may be the point that she's trying to make.
Yes. Now, you know, the book makes some good points, but it also gets a little bit too into the realm of moderation is key, which I'm not a fan of.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that there's a gold nugget in here, even though the tactic that she recommends may not be exactly the best way to do it. For example, I think she recommends, like, maybe you have your salad, your dinner, and then you might have a little dessert, but then you finish with, let's say, a cup of coffee, which isn't as sweet. And so, again, the memory, the last memory that you have of that meal is not of that really high-dense food.
Okay.
Does it work? She suggests it does. I wanted to throw it out there as an option for people to try. I would put it as an optional part of the plan.
Okay.
Yep. Does that sound okay?
Yeah.
You'll like that one, which is cool.
Hey, you know what, though? Just because it doesn't sound good to me doesn't mean it won't work for somebody else.
That's right. Yeah. Very good point.
Hey, somebody out there might be listening going, hey, that is the best idea I've ever heard of.
You know, as I was describing it, I was thinking to myself, you know, I don't like this. And then after I got done, you're like, I don't like this. But you're right. I'm going to throw it out there anyway, just because there may be somebody out there for which that works wonders. So
that's right.
It's a golden nugget out there for somebody. I'm sure somebody will love it.
We're all headed for a destination, but there are hundreds and thousands of ways to get there.
Yes. Good point. Okay. And the final one, Blythe, is fluff your food whenever possible.
Ah, okay.
So whenever you can mix a low-calorie dense food with a high-calorie dense food, you lower the total desire-to-density ratio. Give you an example. If we were to blend a smoothie, okay, with spinach, for example. Most people say, ew, you know, that's disgusting. But the truth is the spinach doesn't add much in the way of taste. You don't really taste the spinach.
Okay.
But you can add a handful, even a handful and a half, two handfuls worth of spinach to a smoothie. And all of a sudden, the density of that smoothie has been decreased by the fact that you've got all this bulk, right?
Okay. I think I have another great example.
Yeah.
Dr. Ray's rainbow salad with a piece of grilled salmon on top.
There you go.
Love a good salad. I think we were talking about this on the Facebook page maybe a month or so ago about mixing some of those. Yeah, you did. You were talking about how to make a salad really desirable, putting some of your favorite things in there like craisins, mandarin oranges, maybe some slivered almonds or choosing something that you really enjoy and putting it into a salad. So you're kind of fluffing up the part you're looking forward to and getting all those good, you know, all the nutrients, all the vitamins and the minerals in the salad.
Oh, this reminds me of a lateral shift I just saw this week. Okay. I posted it on Facebook. Whenever I see these things, I try to post them on Facebook as possible tips. But there's this new item called Amazons. Have you seen these?
Yes, I sure have.
I haven't had a chance to try them, but they're basically, I think they're like tiny little prunes, right?
Yes, they're prunes.
But they're small. They're small like raisins. Mm-hmm. And so they're an alternative to craisins and raisins. Apparently they have 50% less sugar.
More fiber.
Much more fiber.
Yep.
And so it may be a good lateral shift for a lot of people, even those who like the craisins, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And they are so high in sugar, those craisins. Yeah. But if you don't go haywire with them, they are nice to kind of fluff up a salad.
Right. And so these Amazons, which are like these small little freeze-dried prunes, apparently can be an alternative to that, and they offer 50% less sugar, I think 50% more fiber, and a much, much lower glycemic index. So that's an alternative. That's something that people can add to the mix as well if you don't want to add too many craisins.
Yeah, keep your eyes out for new foods and things like that, new ideas.
Yep.
You know, it doesn't hurt to look up recipe Facebook pages or things like that, because every once in a while, it doesn't have to be an actual recipe that you see, but it might be an idea that you get from looking at a recipe.
Right. And, you know, another example would be adding veggies and mushrooms to an omelet.
Yeah.
You know, that's another good example of taking a more calorie-dense food and fluffing it out with much lower calorie-dense foods.
Mm-hmm.
Any other ideas you have? Blending a smoothie rather than just mixing it with a spoon. So if you have, like, a whey protein shake, what they discovered is if you blend it or you froth it up,
yes,
it actually causes you to feel more full for a longer period of time.
It does.
So air could be a good way to lower the calorie density of the food that you're consuming.
Okay. So blending up. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to keep coming up with some ideas, but you kind of got the wheels spinning now, but it's kind of getting late in the podcast.
Yeah. It's a long one, but we owe it to everybody because we've been MIA, but okay, great. So give everybody the information. How did they find us?
Well, guys, make sure you look at our regular website, www.cutthefatpodcast.com. There's no spaces or anything in between there. You can get a link to our Facebook page directly from the website. We do have a few recipes and things on there. I saw on Facebook that somebody was looking for our blog. If you click on the blog tab on our Cut the Fat Podcast website, we do have some articles and things under there. Also, you can find us on Facebook. Just in the search box, enter Cut the Fat Podcast, all one long word. And up we shall pop. What else do we have? Oh, we are going to be leaving you guys again to the Grilled Lincolns. They also have a Facebook page. If you guys haven't checked out the Grilled Lincolns, I believe they just came out with another album, didn't they?
I know one is due soon. Apparently it's going to be one of their better ones.
Okay.
So
I'm looking forward to it. I saw Riddy put some post up there. I didn't know if the album had actually been released yet or not, but check out the Grilled
Lincolns. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Check out the Grilled Lincolns, guys. They're awesome.
All right. Well, thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and got lots of golden nuggets. And we'll see you next time here on.
And we'll keep them coming. We'll keep them coming.
Hopefully faster than this one came. Okay. See you guys.
Bye.
Say you want to try something new. A little twist of what you know is true. You're in a cloudy home, shit don't touch you. And you feel a bliss of pop the pus is blue. And all the sticky things that keep me silent are the same things that make your safe world violent.